Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Welcome to today's debate. My name is Ganesh Taylor, and today we are here to discuss the enigma of energy. So, with no further ado, from the power grid to the fundamental essence of matter, the concept of energy is essential to physics's description of reality. Einstein's famous equation identified all matter as equivalent to energy, and as a result, energy is seen by many as the ultimate constituent of the universe. But there is a danger, as Nobel laureate Richard Feynman, one of the leading scientists of the last 50 years, has pointed out, that we, quote, have no knowledge of what energy is. And some now argue that with no independent confirmation nor explanation for phenomena like dark energy, the whole of physics rests on a mystical notion. Should we conclude that the concept of energy, though enormously useful in physics, is ultimately a mystical idea? Should we abandon the idea that energy describes the physical character of reality? Or is this all a mistake and we should double down on the idea that energy is built into the fabric of the universe? To help us understand and unpick these very large questions, we have a star-studded panel this evening. We have Bernard Carr, who is an Emeritus Professor of Mathematics and Astronomy at Queen Mary University of London, and is well known for his long-standing interest in the relationship between science and spirituality. We're also joined by Priya Natarajan, who is a professor of astronomy and physics at Yale University and is highly regarded for her pioneering work on mapping dark energy and supermassive holes. Last, but by no means least, we have Avshalom Elitzer, who is a professor at the Institute of Quantum Studies at Chapman University in the United States. Avshalom is well known for his work on the Elitzer-Weidman bomb testing problem in quantum mechanics, which inspired Roger Penrose in his book Shadows of Mind. I'm going to ask our panelists to each address a pitch question, and they'll have a few moments to give us their opening thoughts, and then our conversation will flow from there. So, Bernard, I'm going to ask you to speak first for 3 minutes on the question of, should we conclude that the concept of energy, though enormously useful in physics, is ultimately something we know very little about? Bernard.
Thank you. Well, I'm going to argue, actually, we know a lot about energy, but there's still a lot more to discover. And really, I want to put this in a historical perspective, because in classical physics, the concept of energy and the energy conservation is enormously useful. It underlies almost every branch of physics. But it's also a very abstract concept, simply because there are so many different forms of energy. And indeed, as physics has expanded, we've got to know different forms of energy, and there are doubtless other forms of energy which we haven't yet established, we haven't yet discovered. And I think that's why Feynman made his remark. Obviously, we started off with Newton's theory, with the concept of kinetic energy and gravitational potential energy. But then that was expanded to talk about, when the discovery of atomic theory, to talk about thermodynamics and the idea of thermal energy, which was related to the kinetic energy of particles. Then we discovered other forces. We discovered the electromagnetic forces. We discovered the weak forces and the nuclear forces. And all of those are also associated with different forms of energy. And not only do we have these different forces, but there are different types of energy within the current physical paradigm. So you've got biological energy, you've got ecology, you've got sciences, you've got astrophysics and cosmology. All these different areas depend fundamentally on energy. So it's undoubtedly useful. And then, of course, we all know that with special relativity, we had the idea that another form of energy is res mass. And of course, that has transferred our completely transformed our view of what is meant by energy. And then in general relativity, you have the idea that energy and res mass are actually manifested as the curvature of space-time. So obviously our view of energy is becoming more and more complicated. You do, in general relativity, you have energy, but it's called the stress energy tensor. But the crucial point, though, is about energy is that it's supposed to be conserved. And so the idea is that all these different forms of energy, they can be transformed among themselves, providing the total is always fixed. And most laws, there are many conservation laws in physics. Most of them turned out not to be valid. Most of them could be violated. But energy, so far at least, is the one law that does seem to be sacrosanct. Now, of course, when quantum theory came along, the situation became more complicated again, because in quantum theory, energy is like an operator. It's associated with the time derivative in the Schrödinger equation. And also you have the idea that energy can be violated. It can be violated for a short time because of the uncertainty principle. And that gives rise to all sorts of wonderful phenomena. It means that the vacuum has got energy. It means that you have what's called the Casimir effect. You have black hole radiation. And in particular, you have what is sometimes called dark energy, which cosmologists have now discovered. And I'm sure that's going to be a topic of conversation. It makes the complicated more, it makes the idea more complicated, but it provides valuable insights. The crucial thing to me is, in the final theory of physics, which is going to merge relativity theory and quantum theory, there we can expect an even more dramatic transformation of what we mean by energy. We don't know what the final theory of physics is. It probably will go beyond space and time. And obviously, if you go beyond space and time, the concept of energy is also going to be violated. And so I suspect that ultimately, energy will not be the final answer. But for all practical purposes, in terms of current physics, it's a perfectly valid concept and a tremendously useful concept. But I do feel eventually in that final theory of physics, we will have to maybe give it up.
Fascinating. Thank you for sharing that with us, Bernard. Priya, what are your thoughts? Do we know very little about energy, or sounded like we knew quite a lot from what Bernard said?
Actually, we do. I agree with Bernard on this point, that we do know quite a lot about energy. And in fact, it is real, and it's a very powerful concept that actually appears to be an essential feature of physical reality as we have come to observe, measure, and see it. It's a critical concept because it actually allows you to calculate, especially as Bernard alluded, this concept of conservation of energy tells you that energy transmutes forms. Therefore, if you want to understand why a particular body is either at rest or in motion or is accelerating, it's really important to know all the forces that are acting on it and the various ways in which these forces are acting to change, transmute energy from one form to another, say from kinetic to potential, or from kinetic to radiation, for example. And I think the one place that, I mean, the thing that I would want to add about energy, and probably where I slightly disagree with Bernard, is I actually think energy might be sacrosanct. I have every reason to believe that, because I think we will change our definition of energy. And perhaps that's why it will remain sacrosanct going forward. And I think that energy also has some mystical dimensions, right? So there is energy that we are talking about in the universe, where we are making measurements. But there are forms of energy. I mean, if you think about, you know, the word term energy, right? We often use it, even in physics, right? As a source, as a way of providing agency. So if you expand the definition and say energy is, you know, that's as close as science will ever get to talking about agency. So something is energetic, right? So there's an energetic explosion. So there is some kind of emergent behavior that causes a lot of additional phenomenology, right? And I think that as far as dark energy is concerned, I think that term dark energy is really semantic ignorance, because we don't really know what dark energy is. So that's the one, but it's not clear to me that it's actually energy as we have come to understand it in physics. And the reason for that, the reason we adopted that term, is because we wanted to understand what powers the accelerating expansion of the universe. So this was a new feature of our universe that was discovered as recently as 1998, just very recently in the grand scheme of things. And what we didn't know, I mean, from a commonplace experience, you know, if you're in a gas, in a car, and you have to accelerate, you have to press the gas pedal, you have to pump the gas in order to give you that womb to get the acceleration. So you need to supply energy. So it is in that sense that this term dark energy was used. We don't actually know what it is. So its true nature may turn out to not quite be energy, but something else. It remains the most challenging open question in cosmology today.
Fascinating stuff, Priya. I'm also fascinated by the fact that you already mentioned mysticism. We should definitely loop back around to that.
Yeah.
Avshalom, you get your pitch moment now. Should we be concluding that the concept of energy is just something kind of useful for physics, but we don't know much about it? What are your thoughts?
My colleagues have made so many excellent statements that the little is left for me to add. I'll quote a philosopher of science, Karl Popper, who said that unlike a philosophy, science doesn't ask what is questions. That is, usually in science, you don't ask what is matter or what is energy, what is the essence of the thing you are talking about. Rather, you ask how it is related to the other things. It is quite similar to what we do in mathematics. Sometimes we don't know something, so we call it X, and we don't know much about this X or Y, but we play with it. And then just by understanding its relation to other terms or other numbers, then we get X equals this and that. So we are not there yet when energy is concerned. What I can say is that the two great revolutions of modern physics did have achieved the following great feat. Reality is composed of four basic elements, constituents, which is space, time, matter, and energy. Along came a guy who showed first that space and time are somehow one unity, which is space-time. That was Einstein's special and then general relativity. And then also in special relativity, he showed that matter and energy are the same entity that has two aspects and they can turn into one another. That is, Einstein has shown that the law of conservation of energy in itself is wrong. The law of conservation of matter is wrong. But then he generalized them into one law of conservation of matter and energy. Is it possible, and I believe that was Einstein's dream, to show that matter itself and energy itself is some kind of space-time wrapped around itself or curved in a very special way? That is, he was hoping, and this is what string theories and other modern theories are trying to show, that actually we can explain everything in terms of space-time, of this four-dimensional or that manifold which has even more dimensions. Sir Bernard has mentioned quantum mechanics, which has more interesting things to say about energy, but I believe I've exhausted my time for this round. I'll wait for the next one.
Thank you so much, Bernard. Avshalom, that was very, very considerate of you. I mean, okay, so the three of you have really set this scene quite widely. There's a lot to unpack there. I think it would be good to start with a discussion on whether or not, in that case, we should continue using this concept that energy describes the physical character of reality, whatever reality might be. Bernard, why don't you go first?
Well, first of all, I think that it depends on scale. In the context of the normal mundane scales we're used to, I think the idea of energy will continue to be crucial and useful. So in all practical applications, anything to do with ecology or earth sciences or biology or astrophysics, I think in that context, the concept of energy as we understand it will be continue to be useful and valid. But what one has to realize is that when you go to the extremes, that is where the pictures are going to change. So, and that can be either at the larger scale, when we get to the larger scale of the cosmos, that where you, for example, you encounter the dark energy, which Priya referred to. But also when you start talking about the universe, well, what does the energy mean for the whole universe? After all, the universe might be infinite. And then on the other hand, you might go to the smaller scales, the Planck scale, where quantum gravity comes in. And I've already indicated that maybe our whole concept of space and time breaks down there. And therefore, if that were the case, maybe energy would break down. Not necessarily, but maybe energy would also break down. So I would say, should we abandon the idea of energy? Perhaps when you're dealing with the extremes, at either the largest or the smallest extremes. But I think the concept of energy will continue to be vital in at the well in the regimes where most of us were normally living our everyday life and making our observations of the physical universe. And so it comes down to this whole question of whether energy is violated. And, you know, you could ask, well, is energy violated at the Big Bang? Because after all, if the universe starts with a Big Bang, you might say, well, the energy's come from somewhere, so you violated energy. So, but we just don't know. I mean, it's conceivable the energy of the universe is zero, because in some models, the gravitational energy cancels out the rest mass energy and things like that. But we just don't know. But obviously, the question of whether energy is violated at the Big Bang is something we just don't know the answer to. So I would just say we have to be open to that possibility, that our idea of energy, in terms of the ultimate picture of physical reality, may have to change. But I was also very interested when Priya made this reference to mystical, the mystical qualities of energy, because I do think, as I said before, what physics regards as respectable domains of investigation is always changing. We're always encountering new forms of energy. And the particular form of energy which fascinates me, going outside conventional cosmology, is, if you like, the energy associated with mind or with consciousness. And even with mystical experience, which is something one doesn't normally talk about in front of physicists or even philosophers. But I think we want an extended physics which does accommodate that. And the question is, well, how does that energy fit into the normal physical energy? And I'll just leave that as a question for the others to address.
Take it away, Priya. Seems like you've been set
well,
up.
Well, I mean, Bernard raises some really important and big questions. So obviously, I'm not going to be able to answer all of them. But I think that while I agree that we have to be open-minded, I think we don't even have the language of how to frame physics, how to frame, for example, the formation and evolution of the universe without energy as a concept. We just don't have the language for it yet. So I am open-minded that we may have to upend this concept and there'll be something else, more overarching concept, as Avshalom indicated, maybe some way to combine space, time, matter, collapsing everything into something else. But I don't think we have the language for that yet. So, but I'm open-minded. You know, coming back to the question of, you know, when does energy become a useful and important concept for the physical universe? It's, you know, the Big Bang is our T equals zero. Whether any order in the universe existed before that, whether there were any laws at all, is completely unknown. So everything that we know is after, when we set the counter to T equals zero. But after that, for 13.8 billion years forward, it's a concept that really helps understand and integrate the various bridge the various physical scales, physical phenomena that happen in the universe. And I said, and the concept there that's really important is the transmutation of energy, because we first believe that the entire universe was radiation dominated. So all the energy was in the form of radiation. And then it transmutes and some of it gets manifested as matter. Then matter is produced. So that's why I just don't see how we can escape that concept, right? But, you know, as I said, one, as a scientist, one should be open-minded. Coming back to the point that Bernard raised about, you know, the energy of mind and consciousness, I think one aspect of science, which I find is a limit, but this is by definition and by construction, right? We've not yet found a way to integrate our experiential knowledge with scientific knowledge. And I recently came across what I thought was the most apt example, which shows where we have not been looking. So, for example, if you look at earthquake prediction, you look at seismology, right? It's not a very predictive science because you don't actually, the geological activity doesn't start to manifest. You hear some rumbles like maybe days before, but you cannot correlate them to a big earthquake. However, hours and maybe a day or so before, you start detecting scientific data on tremors that often foretells with a pretty high percentage of correlation. However, 24 hours before that, there are recent studies that show that animal behavior starts to become peculiar. And that's data we've never taken into account. Birds start chirping differently, domesticated animals start to feel jittery and so on, right? So I think that there are these gaps in science, very legitimate gaps in science, and we haven't really understood. And, you know, and energy is sort of, as I said, you know, it's the phenomenon that is manifesting all of these kind of various measurements and data that we are taking, scientific data.
Avshalom.
Yeah, I'll stick to the method of not asking what is questions, but rather asking how that thing is related to others. So indeed, there is something very mysterious about energy. If there is some rock being thrown at some place, then the motion is energy. This is kinetic energy. And if there is something hot here, this is energy too. And if there is some electricity or light, this is energy. They seem to be absolutely unrelated, but thanks to the genius of Englishman or British Joule, we know that they, and as Bernard has mentioned, they can be transformed into one another precisely, just as you know how to exchange dollars for euros, for sterlings, and so on. And it works perfectly in physics, and never you see any violation unless you, energy turns into matter or the other way around, which again falls into a very precise equation. So we don't actually, what we see are manifestations of energy, and you're correct that. So what is energy? This is a manifestation of energy. This is a manifestation of energy. What is energy? And honestly, I don't know, but then I'll remind you that I don't know even what matter is. You know how Sir Arthur Eddington began his book? He brought closer his two chairs to his two desks. Come on, you have one chair and one desk? He said, no, there is the chair and the desk which are accessible to my consciousness, to my senses, and they have this kind, these physical attributes. But have I been a bat? I'll continue what he said. I don't know whether he said that, but have I been a bat, then my chair wouldn't look dark with this color or that color, but some configuration of sound waves. And have I been a mole, then it would be some configuration of electricity. But what is the chair itself? That's a question which the philosopher is asking and the scientist tries to evade, although it's very important and it gives us inspiration. I'll tell you what I found in quantum mechanics, which is amazing and keeps amazing me ever since, and my colleagues probably know about it. It began with the work of the late Israeli physicist Jacob Bekenstein, and then Hawking, and then Davis. Here is a silly question. What is the energy of the vacuum, of the nothingness? Now, that's a silly question. There is no energy when, if I take a jar and there is no gas in it and no dust and nothing, there is no matter and no radiation, so there is no energy. So the answer should be zero, right? Just zero. Wrong. The uncertainty principle tells you that nothing can be precise in quantum mechanics, and zero, what can you do, is too precise. So you can't have zero energy. Now that sounds silly. Look, there is vacuum there. So there can't be any energy. What do you know? It turns out that the vacuum itself is something very vibrant, very, shall I say, creative? Because in this vacuum, particles and antiparticles, matter and antimatter, in some sense, energy and negative energy are being formed and annihilated, formed and annihilated. And then there are some, oh yes, and you can make some experiments. I mean, that was Hawking's idea of black hole radiation. But along came a guy who is fortunately still with us, Undru, and say that by the equivalence of general gravity and acceleration, here is an experiment: take a molecule, accelerate it within empty space within the vacuum, and what do you know? It will radiate just as Hawking said that a black hole should radiate. In this way, you extract energy from the nothingness, which I find amazing. Of course, the universe is not going to let you get away with it, because then you owe something to the universe and it will get even with you. But this is an example how fruitful is the scientific method of not asking what is questions, but saying, I don't know what is this and I don't know what is that, but how are they related to one another? How do they interact with one another? And then they do wonderful things. And then as they do that and you learn more and more, then you come closer to the what is questions, which I'm going to address later when we come to the mystical part of the discussion. Oh yes, I also have thoughts about thoughts which are mystical, and I decided that I came to the age in which I can come out of the closet and confess them.
I'm loving this energy that you're all bringing to the conversation this evening. Let's speak honestly. Let's do it. Avshalom, that was a really interesting image. As a biologist, I don't really think about vacuum very often, but I feel like the picture you painted was positively effervescent, like it's foaming. I've never considered it in that light, and I really enjoyed you sharing that. Bernard, you also sort of, I was really struck by the fact that when you were describing what is energy, you were talking about ecological energy and you know, you said biological energy as well, I think, which again, you know, I think we typically think of energy as being completely within the domain of physics rather than all these other places. And then of course, you know, Priya, as you reminded us, that all the things that we interact with in the world around us are in fact energy, right? And I feel like that ties in with what Avshalom was saying about how we sort of, as scientists often will sort of avoid some of the difficult concepts because it becomes difficult to sort of engage with them in the activities that we're involved in. But I mean,
one more comment in your permission, very brief. Although we are theoretical physicists, we should not forget, and we do not forget, that humanity today, the biosphere, humanity, all the nations are under great danger because we have been messing around with energy in the world. We have been so irresponsible in the way that we treat energy. We wasted energy. Energy comes together with entropy, and this problem of the climate that we inherit to the next generation worries me tremendously. I'm sure that it worries my colleagues. And as scientists, we should always call attention to this problem that we inherit, to our shame, to the generations to come.
What do you two think of that? Please, Bernard.
Well, yes, you mentioned the distinction between physics and biology and things, but the point, of course, is that most scientists take a reductionist view in which ultimately everything's explained in terms of physics. So you have physics, which is the basis of chemistry, which is the basis of biology, which is the basis of ecology, and all the way up to consciousness, presumably. So, but the point is that if you do believe that physics underlies everything, that's why this concept of energy plays such an important role in all these different domains. And of course, it's full of obviously all sorts of sociological significance as well, such as the salvation of humanity. So we need to understand energy and maybe have new sources of energy in order to survive and in order to avoid, I mean, these new energies, we might destroy ourselves with them if we destroy ourselves in a nuclear conflagration. On the other hand, maybe they will be our salvation. Maybe there'll be some form of dark energy which we can exploit to survive. Who can tell?
So I'm curious in that case, what actually would happen? Like, Priya, I think you said, well, maybe the definition of energy is going to change. And Bernard, I think you also said that, you know, how we understand energy is different at the sort of two extremes available of the sort of scales that we can look at. So what actually would, what would happen to all those different layers, and how would physics be fundamentally changed if we change our definition of energy?
Well, I don't think it's so much a question of definition of energy. The question is, what would be replacing it? And of course, we don't know what the final theory of physics is. I mean, all I would claim is that there will be a final theory of physics which will go beyond relativity theory and quantum theory. And that final theory will relate to what happens at t equals naught, at the Big Bang. I entirely agree with Priya that after t equals naught, everything is straightforward. But the question of what happens at t equals naught is precisely the question of what happens in that final theory, because that's when you're in the domain of quantum gravity. And we don't have such a theory. I, however, suspect that another concept which may come in may be information. I think that there is evidence that information may be an important part of some final theory of physics. I mean, energy may still be there, but I, what worries me about that is that I think the very concept of space and time and it's themselves may turn out to be invalid when you get to this level of quantum gravity. And if you don't have space and time, I don't know how you can have your concept of energy. But we don't know. Maybe energy will be sacrosanct even there. But you see, the conservation of energy at a deep level is associated with the fact that the laws of physics are time invariant. This is to do with what's called Nernst's theorem. And therefore, if you lose time, I suspect you lose energy conservation, but we don't really know.
Avshalom, you're nodding. Priya, you're nodding too.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the remarkable things about energy conceptually, the way we've used it in physics and beyond, is the law, the conservation of energy, which brings order into the universe, right? So any system that we study, we are able to bring order. But the remarkable feature is that these conservation laws appear to hold everywhere in the universe, right? So the laws that tell you how much radiation should come out of an individual hydrogen atom, if it's kicked, if it's triggered and excited with some radiation and out pops the electron, that precise, those energy levels are fixed. So whether you measure it here on Mars or some far corner of the universe, it appears that these laws hold true. And I think that is what is remarkable. And I think that's partly the fact that this ordering principle concept, if you will, has universal applicability is what allows us to know all of this, all of these features of the early universe, the late universe, and how our universe is evolving. You know, and responding to Avshalom's point about, you know, the energy, like humans, we have figured out how to manipulate multiple forms of energy, be it, smashing the atom and releasing the energy from stored in this sort of subatomic domain, or, you know, destroying and exploiting resources on the planet, which is also energy. Stored forms of energy that, be it coal, be it, you know, forests and trees but I think we've been highly irresponsible with this capacity that we have built for ourselves. And so I think that, you know, we can never be too far away from thinking about energy for any system. And I agree with both Bernard and Avshalom that, you know, it's impossible to separate out all these spheres from the energetic point of view, if you will.
That's interesting. Avshalom, I saw you nodding along when Bernard was saying about information.
Bernard has introduced a very important concept to the discussion, information. Do you know that one of the most fruitful paradoxes in the history of physics ever is due to James Clerk Maxwell through his famous Maxwell's demon? Our colleague Ximena Canales, you hosted in our last meeting, wrote a beautiful book about these demons. So Maxwell's demon shows that there is a paradox concerning entropy and energy, which I will not go into here. There is a lot of interesting literature, but he showed that actually there are some processes in which it turns out that there is a paradox unless you have to calculate not only the matter and energy within the system, but also the information. That was a huge surprise because until that time, people thought that information has to do with engineering, with communication, with literature, philosophy, or whatever. It turns out that it is a currency which has something to do with energy and with matter, and it becomes extremely important when you are dealing with life, because life actually is information. Mm-hmm. When Darwin tells you that evolution means accommodating or being adapted to the environment, that means that your genome is incorporating throughout evolution mm-hmm. more and more information about the environment. So actually what we have here is that we are all lawful Maxwell demons. We are not violating any physical law because somehow we have paid with energy in the information which is coded within us. And once again, it reminds us our great responsibility to the huge biodiversity in our biosphere, which we should be mindful of that being now in danger of the Homo sapiens destroying. And I guess that this notion of information will come later in this discussion, and it is profoundly related to the other basic elements of physical reality.
Well, I mean, let's start moving in that direction. I'm really curious now. Could one of you sort of, define what you mean by information at the physics level? Like, what does that actually mean? Am I allowed to ask that question?
I will pass that question to Avshalom.
Yeah, me too.
Okay.
I don't have.
I would say the following. We know what signals is, and we are surrounded by signals. So actually, information is everywhere. But life is unique in the sense that it can extract from very small signals great. Yeah, we should say that meaning. And here I should confess that I'm in a minority in the physical community. Léon Brillouin, and I believe that even before him, the fathers of information theory, say that you can measure the amount of information, you can measure the fidelity of the information, the precision of the information, but information value has nothing to do with mathematics. There can be no mathematical description of the value of information. To quote Léon Brillouin, E equals mc squared has information in it, but as far as information theory is concerned, it has the same information amount of any string of five letters. And I always thought that this is wrong. And actually, that physics and then biology can measure the value of the information. Just take Maxwell's demon in this case. Maxwell has shown that for the demon to sort the molecules within his thought experiment, that demon, he or she needs some information, which means that once you have information, you can save energy for that. And all biological systems are using little energy compared to the work that they are doing, but they use it very cleverly. So I would say, if I have to define information, that will be offhand, but the capability, some systems have the capability to extract meaning out of small signals, signals of energy, once again, I have to come to the question of meaning. Information has something to do with meaning, and information theory has been trying to avoid it, the value of information, the importance of information. I think today that mathematics and physics are capable of dealing with that and even quantifying this measure.
And I think this is so important, the relationship between information and energy, because you know, Einstein famously made the relationship between mass and energy. But you can also ask, well, what's the relationship between information and energy? And they're not the same, but on the other hand, they are linked. I mean, if I take my memory stick, for example, imagine it's in my hand, this memory stick has got a lot of information, gigabytes of information. And in some sense, that's implicitly contained in energy, but it's not a lot of mass. I mean, if I fill my memory stick with information, its mass goes up probably a tiny amount. But so there is a link between energy, mass, and information, but it's a very subtle one, and it also relates to the whole question of entropy, which is, or negentropy. And so it involves all sorts of different branches of physics.
I love the idea that that's why my bag gets heavier with every single file I put onto my laptop.
By a small amount.
one small addition. The first maxim of information theory is that any operation that you want to do with information, creating information, storing information, processing information, erasing information, each of these operations has its price in energy. So this is somewhat similar to the great feat made by Joule of relating all kinds of energy to one another. Now it turns out that if you bring information to the calculation, it has its price in energy. And once you have information, you can save energy. It's extremely profound. And I would suggest everyone, there is an anthology, you know, just like you have in literature, anthology on love, anthology on friendship, and so on. There is a beautiful anthology by two American professors, Rex and Leff, Maxwell's Demon, and I used to buy it as a gift to my students. They took all the papers from Maxwell's original letter. It was not even a paper, just a letter which caused such a great headache to generations of physicists, to the more modern, until Feynman, and until our Landau and Bennett to our day. So I recommend to everybody the volume on Maxwell's Demon by Harvey Leff and Rex. Just a source of learning in physics, mathematics, philosophy, biology, everything.
So you know, coming back to this concept, this notion that that Avshalom just raised, that you know, information costs us energy, which is why I don't think information as a concept is going to subsume energy. So information is not what I think is going to replace the idea of energy, but I think it's a very important facet. It's another form. And I think the example is really apt, that it's another form in which energy gets transmuted. So I would see information as a manifestation, another manifestation of energy. How fundamental it is an open question. It is very important. It's very significant. And information codes many things, as have been brought to this conversation. You know, it encodes life. I want to question Avshalom about, you know, meaning and value are attributes that we put on to information, that we paint on to information or energy or life, right? Intrinsically, there is meaningless information, there is nonsense information, and there is useful information, right? So I would like him to, I would like to push him a little bit to talk about what about useless information? I mean, and say something more than, you know, no information is useless. Maybe he holds that view. I'm just very curious to see.
I must confess that you caught me unprepared. I have to think about it. Bernard has mentioned entropy, which is extremely important. When the founder of information theory, Shannon, thought how to measure information, then somebody, von Neumann, advised him, use entropy as your basis. So we all know that entropy is a very important fundamental concept in physics, in cosmology, in theoretical physics, and so on, because we have this problem of the error of time, why the universe goes in one direction and not the other. We have the other question, which is on the border of philosophy. Is time moving in there? Is there a moving now? I had a debate with Tim Modlin, which is still, which we still have. Is our world block universe, four dimensions without any change, or is there some mysterious creation, genuine creation of future events by which the future becomes the present and then the past? I would answer in the positive. So information is something very profound in that it is related to the other thing which we don't like, which is entropy, but which is the mother of all life. I mean, life apparently goes against entropy, but has there been no entropy, there would not be life. I believe that in Faust of Goethe, there is a famous verse when the devil says, I am part of nature that always would create evil, but does good. I would say that this is how entropy is related to the great mystery of life.
I think one reason it's so interesting that we're having the discussion about information is because, as I think we're going to talk about later, I think it's very interesting to know how you can bring mind into physics and consciousness into physics. And of course, not every physicist thinks you can, but personally, I think one can. But of course, the information, when you talk about information and meaning, you're beginning to talk in terms of the language of mind. And indeed, even Ashlohm referred to the problem of time and the passage of time, and that also relates. It all relates, because the passage of time requires that you go beyond the standard view of physics.
So let's do it now, Bernard. Let's talk about it. What happens if we incorporate consciousness into this image that we have?
Well, I have to say, these are things in physics, consciousness used to be a rather taboo word. It's now becoming more respectable, and I'm retired now, so I can talk about these things without getting into too much trouble. But I've always taken the view that the standard view of physics is triumphant in that it's got this wonderful explanation of all physical structures from the Planck scale all the way up to the scale of the physical universe. So, and that really is a triumph. And yet it's the triumph of mindlessness, because there's no room in that for the observer, for mind. And so I've always argued I want an extension of physics which is going to accommodate consciousness and experience. I do think that consciousness is fundamental. That doesn't necessarily imply that it's part of physics, because physicists traditionally say, well, physics is concerned with the third person description and not the first person description. However, I disagree. I like to think that there will be a form of physics which is going to accommodate consciousness and even first person experience, though it is going to require a rather radically different view. Of course, there are various reasons why you might think that consciousness comes into physics. I mean, people refer to the quantum theory, and some people say the collapse of the wave function requires consciousness. Not every physicist thinks that, but at least it's one possibility. I've always been fascinated in the anthropic principle, which argues that there are fine tunings between the constants of physics, which seem to be necessary in order to have stars and galaxies and people and indeed observers. And of course, neuroscience has to be discussing whether does the physics of the brain explain consciousness. So 20 years ago, you could never talk about consciousness without getting into trouble, and you couldn't talk about the anthropic principle without getting into trouble. I mean, I did, but I got into trouble. But the point is, now you can talk about it because of all these developments. So I really do think that there must be a form of physics which is going to accommodate consciousness and mental experience. And of course, I'm not the only person to say that. Someone like Roger Penrose has always said it. But the point is that I don't think you'll find consciousness in relativity theory, because it doesn't describe the passage of time. I don't think you'll even find consciousness in quantum theory. I mean, you may find hints that consciousness is relevant, but I don't believe quantum theory is going to explain mental experience, although it may show the observer is relevant. I think if you're going to find consciousness, it's going to be in that final theory, which is going to marry up relativity and quantum theory. Every physicist accepts those theories are incompatible. There must be some final theory. And so I think if you're going to find consciousness in physics, it will be at the level of that final theory. And that's why I was interested when we started talking about the possibility that that final theory information may play a role, because that, of course, also links them to mind and meaning and things like that. I have my own particular approach to how one can put mind into physics, but I think perhaps I should answer that in a subsequent question, else I'll be going on too long, but maybe I can, the others could react.
Well, I mean, I think that I don't know, I'm a little torn on this question, right? I mean, I agree that, you know, there has to be a way within science in which you can talk about using experiential knowledge to integrate in, you know, our forms of inference and induction and deduction. However, and I agree that neuroscience is now starting to using, you know, fMRI, they're starting to map the brain and map brain activity, trying to link that to neuronal activity, electrical impulses, to actual motor activity and cognition. So all of that is starting. But, you know, there's a part of me that comes out of perhaps, I mean, you know, cosmic humility. Why should we, with an organ the size of a cantaloupe, gelatinous blob in our heads, be able to figure all of this out? Maybe there will be a limit to knowledge, and maybe we won't get there. I don't know. I feel torn about this. Much as I would like us to figure everything out, including mind and consciousness, and integrate it to our current systems of knowledge, expand our current systems of knowledge, there's a part of me that also pulls and tugs and says, well, you know, there's no reason why we as humans with, you know, should be able to figure all of this out.
Well, I mean, Priya, I agree with you. It's a miracle that we have been so successful in figuring out what we've figured out about the physical world. I mean, absolutely, we've only been thinking about it as physicists for 300 or 400 years, and with the brain the size of a pea, and yet somehow we seem to have got this amazingly complete description of physics. So I know it might seem even more arrogant to assume we can have a theory, a final theory, which is going to accommodate consciousness, but our arrogance in trying to explain the physical world turned out to be justified. So maybe we'll be lucky, and our arrogance in trying to explain the mental world will also be justified. I mean, I just don't know. But I do think at least there is a hope, because I think, I suppose I say that because I've got my own approach to how physics could be expanded. But I mean, nevertheless, what is undoubtedly true is that I think most physicists probably are rather reluctant to say that physics will even in principle be able to explain consciousness. And this would have been a rather heretical idea even maybe a decade ago. But that's why I'm quite pleased I'm retired, because I can say this without getting into too much.
No, but I think you're right that it's a question that is now acknowledged as a question in the mainstream, for sure.
Yes.
Especially with what's happening in cognitive neuroscience.
Yeah.
The next frontier.
Absalom. The old father of reductionism, Democritus, who lived in ancient Greece, wrote many important papers. We have a fragment, a beautiful and charming fragment by Democritus, about the dialogue between the mind and the intellect. The mind and the senses, the intellect and the senses. And it goes something like that. The senses say to the intellect say to the senses, poor senses, you don't understand anything. You think that there are colors, that there are tastes, that there are smells and sounds. Actually, there are only atoms and the void. And then the senses answer to the intellect, poor intellect, your victory is your defeat, because it is from us that all your ideas come from. So there is some loop here. And then it goes to my colleagues said. There is something mysterious about consciousness. And when I was in London, I gave a talk about the mystery of consciousness. I'll summarize it very briefly. Suppose the four of us are going outside in some field, and I say, look at this beautiful red flower. And then look at this beautiful blue flower. And I'm satisfied that we are not color, none of us is colorblind. And I find out that we all refer to red as red and blue as blue in all languages that we know. Suppose also that all of us are neurophysiologists and we can probe into each other's brain, neuron for neuron and synapse to synapse. So I know better than Bernard what goes within his brain when he sees red and blue, more even than Bernard himself knows. Science says that it's possible, not within present day technology, but within a few decades. There is one thing that I cannot rule out. Perhaps every time that Bernard sees something blue, he says, look what a beautiful red. And every time that he sees some red, he thinks that it is blue, because ever since he was born, his mother said, look at this blue. And he saw a blue strawberry, but his mother said, look at this beautiful red strawberry. And to this day, he believes that this is blue and this is red. Nothing in science, it's very important, nothing in science, nothing in neurosciences can rule out the possibility that we have conscious experiences being crossed, being replaced, or even that we are zombies. I know that I'm not a zombie, but can I be sure that you're not a zombie or Priya is not a zombie? I can't rule this out. So there is something very mysterious about consciousness that is the more advanced that neurophysiology is making, it becomes even more mysterious, which is really troubling. I think that the way out of it, this is my way out of it, is to say the following. Wow, I've studied physics, I've studied chemistry, I studied biology, I studied neurophysiology, and then consciousness is a mystery. Are you sure that you know enough about physics at the very beginning? What do you know about matter? What do you know about energy? I ate dinner earlier. Now this dinner is part of me. So there is something about matter and energy that I don't know, but I know firsthand. This is the first person. What I'm talking to you now, the agent who is talking to you is just matter and energy. And there is a theory in philosophy. There is dualism and epiphenomenalism and parallelism, but the one to which I feel the greatest sympathy is panpsychism, which says that there is something very mysterious to consciousness. We don't understand it because it is there all the way down. It doesn't mean that my chair is conscious or my desk is conscious, but it means that perhaps within any particle, within any quantum, whether matter or energy, there is something which is still not yet accessible to science, not yet. And the source of the mystery of consciousness is there in matter and energy, in the universe itself. I know that it sounds very mystical, but I think that, yes.
Well, talking about mysticism, Priya, you mentioned mysticism, and then Bernard, we can give you the final word because we're approaching the end.
I think this issue of the nature of consciousness is so fundamental. And I also think the crucial assumption that most physicists and certainly most neuroscientists would make is that consciousness is just something generated by the brain. However, there is another view, which is that the brain is a filter of consciousness rather than the generator of consciousness. Now, of course, this is a heretical view in some quarters, but it's an old philosophical tradition. It goes back to Henri Bergson and William James, the idea that rather like a TV set, you look at a TV set and you know that what's happening in the picture is not really happening in the TV set. It's being transmitted to the TV set. And I think there's this view of consciousness that says the brain is a filter of consciousness. And I would say there's even some evidence of that that comes from what's called terminal lucidity, where people with Alzheimer's suddenly become more clear. People take psychedelics and the parts of the brains which should be excited seem to be suppressed. And going into the more mystical domains, people might have a near-death experience where the brain is flatlined and yet they're having a more intense experience of reality in some sense. So I personally think that this means that the view that consciousness is generated by the brain actually is incorrect. Of course, neuroscientists study the correlations between your experience and what is in the brain, but that doesn't imply that the brain is generating the experience. So it doesn't mean that the everything you experience is actually in your head. It just means there's something inside your head which correlates with that external reality. And I think that's going to be a crucial feature of this final theory of physics, because if you're going to have a final theory of physics, which is going to accommodate the question of consciousness, you have to address that question. And my personal view is that there is, if you like, consciousness with a big C, which is filtered through the brain with a little C, and that in some sense is going to be part of this final theory of physics. But I realize this is heretical from a mainstream physics point of view, and I don't know whether either Priyo or Asher Lama are going to be open to that idea. But uh-huh. I think that's a crucial feature of this. I think this will be a crucial feature of the final theory of physics, that consciousness is not just generated by the brain. The brain is a filter of consciousness. But I happily
agree. There was a German physiologist, Emile de Bois-Reymond, who mentioned in a famous lecture all the great unsolved mysteries of science, and then he related to consciousness, and then he made the following statement in Latin: ignoramus et ignorabimus. We don't know, and we will never know. I agree that we don't know. I dare to take exception to, I beg to differ with de Bois-Reymond and say that I'm not sure that we will not know. There is something waiting for us, very exciting physics waiting for us to be discovered. And consciousness is going to be part and parcel of that.
My gosh, on that note, I am so loath to calling time on this. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Delighted to have been part of this conversation.
Thank you for listening to Philosophy for Our Times. We will shortly be getting a new email specifically for you, and we'd love to hear more from you. If you have any questions for our speakers or our editorial team, make sure you stay posted, as we would love to hear from you in the near future.
Thanks for listening.
Thank you.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.